In my own experience as a Christian, one of the really breakthrough moments for me in my handling of Scripture was understanding how the whole thing held together. I was brought up in a very biblical church, but often the Bible was used in a quite atomized way, a verse here and a verse there and a story there, and getting a feel for how the whole thing held together and what the whole thing was about was quite a significant step forward for me in my own Christian journey. And so I thought, well, there might be other people who would either like to revisit the Bible as a whole entity, or perhaps people who've never done that anyway and would be interested to know how the bits fit together. Now, obviously, in an hour-ish, and I deliberately haven't defined the ish, but in the hour-ish, we're going to go quite quickly and across the surface. So there'll be moments, perhaps, when we might wish we could stop and go more deeply into particular issues or passages or books. But clearly, because of the project that we've set ourselves, it's not going to be possible to do that. So if you have really burning questions about bigger issues that we skate over, then as last week, Paul is very generously offered to be around for as long as you'd like so that you can pick up on that. Also, because of the nature of the beast, I mean, and I apologize for this up front, but it's going to be pretty much me talking through the Bible, and I'll try and perhaps put in one moment where we can just draw breath together, but fundamentally it's going to be a bit of a headlong walk or talk through the Bible. So, let's try and make a start. Oh, and the other thing I should say, of course, is that because my hope was there might be people here who'd never done this, I'm trying to keep it as basic as possible so that it doesn't kind of go over anybody's head. If I fail in that, I apologise up front. So what is the Bible? The Bible is a collection of 66 books written by 40-plus authors over at least 1,500 years. You'll be familiar with the books of the Bible, I guess, which are presented to us in our Bibles, if you look through your index at the front, in a certain order. The order is not chronological. The order is ordered by the kind of books that are clustered together in different parts of the Bible. So the first five books are called the books of the law, sometimes called the books of Moses, sometimes called the Torah, the law, Genesis through to Deuteronomy. There's then a load of books on the shelf describing the history of Israel, starting from Joshua and then ending, as you can see there, at Esther. Then at the end of the top shelf, there is a little collection of poetry and prayer books, sometimes called the wisdom books. And then the whole of the rest of what we call the Old Testament is comprised of writings of the prophets. The first few, usually called the major prophets, simply because they wrote a lot. And then the other 12 called the minor prophets, because they didn't write quite so much. Their message was equally significant, but they had less to say. That ends the Old Testament. The words testament simply mean covenant. It's the same word. And so what we've got up to that point is, and the word covenant means promise, God's promise and God's commitment to people, to live in a particular relationship with them. So up until that point, we've got a description of the old covenant, the old way that God related to people. But we then move into the New Testament, or the new covenant period, with four books about Jesus, and then a fifth by Luke called Acts, and Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts. And then a whole cluster of letters from the Apostle Paul, some letters from the other apostles, Peter and John amongst them. And then finally, standing by itself and slightly blurred on the screen, is the book of Revelation. So that's it. I did it in well under an hour. How's that? So these different categories of literature describe the way that the Bible has been put together, our Bible. The Old Covenant books, the Old Testament books, would be called the Hebrew Bible by Jewish people, and their books would be ordered in a slightly different order. Their Bible, our Old Testament, finishes with the book of Chronicles, and the other books, the prophets, are reordered slightly earlier. But the whole story finds its focus in the life and ministry and teaching of Jesus. Those books, coming quite late in the list of books, actually are the hub of the wheel. They're the books that explain what all of the rest of the books are about. And what they're about, in broad outline, here is the one sentence description of what the Bible is all about. It's the story of God's resolve to enjoy a worldwide family of people who love him, love one another, and love his planet. That's what the Bible's all about. It's a story about God's resolve to enjoy a relationship with a worldwide family of people who love him, love one another, and love his planet. The whole of the Bible narrative, the whole of the Bible story, describes God's determination to achieve that end, as we'll see. Someone described this set of books as like a play in a number of acts. If you think of it in those terms, if you go to see a play, you see different scenes and different acts, and each one moves you a little bit further through the story. The first scene of the play describes the creation of everything by God, and then the breakdown of everything as human beings who are supposed to help run God's creation turn their back on God, but run his creation anyway. The so-called fall, as it's often described. Scene one, act one. That moves into the story of Israel and the nations. And the story of Israel and the nations through the rest of the Old Testament all points and moves towards the life and ministry and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ as God's ultimate rescue of his intention to have a worldwide family of people that love him, love one another, and love his planet. From Jesus, we read that a number of people got it. A number of people decided that what Jesus was saying was worth trusting. And the rest of the New Testament describes the spread of the Jesus people throughout the Mediterranean and the then known world. And finally, the final act of the play, we see in the book of Revelation a whole revelation of what's going on in the world from God's perspective, climaxing with the end of the story, which I'm now giving the game away and you're going to go home now, where God gets a worldwide family of people who love him, love one another, and love this planet. So, that's the overview. Draw a breath. Here's a few more nuts and bolts. So we start with the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis is divided into two sections. The first section, verses chapters 1 to 11, describes God's relationship with the world. And the second part describes God's relationship with Israel, or the beginnings of his relationship with Israel. So we start with those famous chapters where God created everything by speaking. We see in those words not a scientific account of how the world came into being, but the big, bold truth and claim that everything that exists exists because God willed it to be so. We're not told how he did it, we're told that he did it. That's the important message of Genesis 1. We do not live in a world of blind, random chance and fate. We live in a world that's been designed by a designer and a creator. That's the claim of the beginning of the book. And we see in that claim, God's intention is not just to preside over a world, but actually to partner with the creation itself. So Adam and Eve are placed in that world and are invited to be God's partners in running the world. His co-regents, if you will. So the invitation is not just to believe that God is the governor of the world, but actually that God, as governor of the world, calls human beings into relationship with him to help run it. The fact that they chose not to do that, symbolized by their rebellion in the Garden of Eden, resulted in this terrible fracturing of God's world where human relationships with God were fractured. They were hiding from God. Their relationships together were fractured. The woman made me do it. No, he did it. She did it. And their relationship with the earth was broken. It now was a place of hardship and weeds and thistles and all kinds of other stuff. So what we see in Genesis 1 and 2 and 3 is a beautiful creation designed by a good God, designed to be run with human beings, part of his creation, but one which is fractured at every level. Spiritually, between humankind and God, relationally, between humans and humans, and environmentally, between humans and the planet they live on. That's how the story begins. So God's project to get a worldwide family of people who love him, love one another, and love his planet doesn't get off to a great start. It found us fairly quickly. And we see accounts through the beginning of the book of Genesis of a number of stories that illustrate just how far the world fell from God's intentions. The story of Abel and Cain, the brother that murdered the other brother. The story of the flood, where we read those terrible words in Genesis 6, that it grieved God's heart that he'd made this because humankind was so wicked and horrible to one another. What have I brought into being? And the Tower of Babel, which finally symbolized humanity turning against God completely and trying to be their own gods. That's the opening of the whole story of the Bible. You might think that at that point God would wash his hands of the whole thing and give up, which he nearly did in the flood. But of course he didn't, because someone made it through the flood, Noah and his family, and they were given exactly the same words as Adam had been given, to fill the earth and subdue it. God relaunched his project post-flood with Noah and his family, because he still wanted a worldwide family of people that loved him, loved one another, and loved his planet. You're going to be fed up with that phrase by the end of the evening, but at least you'll remember it. And so God moves and initiates a plan to rescue the rebellious world through the family of one particular person, Abraham, an Iraqi from Ur, a foreigner, if you will, who is invited by God to transplant himself into a new location and to start a new project in the earth. And he's given this commission by God in Genesis chapter 12. These are some of the most important words in the Bible to get what the Bible's all about. The Lord said to Abraham, as he was then called, "Go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. And I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who curse you." I'll bless those who bless you, and whoever curses, well spotted, whoever curses you, I will curse. And get this, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. What God had started with Adam and Eve, a family of people that loved him and loved one another and would work at loving his planet, he relaunches with Abraham. You will become a great family, a great nation. But not for your own sake. Through you, I will continue the work that I wanted Adam and Eve to do, to bring my blessing to the very ends of this now broken earth. Throughout the Bible, you see time and time again that God always positions himself somewhere in a people for the good of everywhere else, the not people. And here you get that for the first time. So at the end of the book of Genesis, God's family have grown a bit, and there's been people like Jacob and Esau and all those stories. And we get the story of Joseph, if you remember, is sold into Egypt by his brothers. And God's family, Abraham's family, suddenly find themselves translocated because there's a famine in the land where they were living. They all end up in Egypt and they become slaves. And the book of Exodus then picks up the story of God's people now captive in Egypt under the world superpower of the time, the Putin of his day, Pharaoh, captive there making bricks for his building projects. God determines that his people will be set free to become a nation again, a body of people that love him and love one another and love his planet for the good of the whole. And so he frees these slaves by sending Moses, who'd been brought up half Egyptian, half Hebrew, and so knew the ropes inside Egypt. And he sent him back into Egypt to Pharaoh's palace to tell Pharaoh that he had to let God's people go. Time was up. They can't be slaves anymore. Pharaoh didn't immediately think this was a great plan, and so resisted somewhat. And you'll know the story of the plagues and so on, as God progressively tried to convince Pharaoh that really Pharaoh wasn't God after all, but God was truly God. And if God wanted something, then you better play ball with it. And finally, there's that terrible moment when the angel of God visits Egypt, and the firstborn are killed in every household, apart from in the Hebrew household, because they have substituted for their firstborn children a lamb. And by painting the blood of that lamb on the door frames of their houses, the vengeance of God against Pharaoh would pass over them. And they would be secure. The first Passover was thus initiated, where a lamb was slain to take the place of others, and they could be set free. The people escape into the wilderness, through the Red Sea, and become in the wilderness a nation for the first time. All of these former slaves suddenly become a people, and they are given a particular way to worship God and a particular place to worship God. The tabernacle. It's like a great big tent, and in the middle of the tent there's a particular place, and in the particular place is where God was believed to meet with people. There was something in there called the Ark of the Covenant, and inside the Ark of Covenant there was the law that God had given to Moses, and God was said to meet with people at that place. It was right in the middle of this big tented enclosure called the tabernacle. It was a recreation of Eden. If you look at the way that it's all put together, there are deliberate echoes of Eden. Eden, if you remember, was the place where God dwelt with humankind in the middle of the rest of his creation. The whole earth was God's earth, but Eden was that place where he resided with human beings. Now in the wilderness, a new kind of portable Eden was constructed, a place where God dwelt with humankind in his earth for the sake of the whole, but a particular place where people could come and meet him and address him. The people wandered through the wilderness following the red line, just as well it was there, otherwise they wouldn't have known where to go. And for quite a while, there were all kinds of things that happened on that long journey. It wasn't supposed to be a long journey. There was a much shorter way to get to the land that God had promised them. But their constant rebellion meant that God felt they needed to stay in the wilderness to learn how to be a people and how to worship and love him before they got to the promised land. And so the next book in the story is the book of Leviticus, where God tells people how to live a holy life. While you're wandering in the desert, you've got this tabernacle, but what does it mean to live a holy life? And there's this famous verse which comes a number of times in the Bible: I am holy, and so you should be holy, because I'm holy. If you're my people, you've got to reflect me in some way. You've got to reflect my character, my goodness. And so you'll find in the book of Leviticus all kinds of instructions about what it means to be holy. And what it means to be holy, interesting, if you read it, and I hope you will read some of these bits when you go home and think, what on earth was that? I didn't get that. I hope you'll read some of these things. You'll see that holiness is a very practical thing. It's about respecting your parents. It's about treating creation properly. It's about building your homes carefully. It's about reflecting in everything that you do as a human being the character of God. It's not about shining with some sort of wonderful light and floating 6 inches above the floor. That's not what it means to be holy. To be holy means to be like God, to have God's concerns, God's heart, and to act as God would act were he you. Treating your kids how God would treat your kids. You read through the book of Leviticus, some very practical things about diet, about building, all designed to make Israel this particularly unique nation that reflected a very different character to the other nations around. So that Israel would become a kind of a light to the other nations. So they could see how life could really work when people really cared for one another and really loved one another and really followed the true and living God. So Leviticus gives those instructions for holy life. And the next book, which is the book of Numbers, describes the journey through the wilderness. 38 years of grumbling and grief from the Israelites' perspective, and grace and guidance from God's perspective. They were always grumbling at Moses. What on earth did you bring us out here for? We could have been back in Egypt eating all that wonderful food. Isn't it amazing how short people's memories are? We could have been back there eating all of those cucumbers and onions. I mean, You must be in a bad state if you long to eat cucumbers and onions, in my opinion, but that's just a dietary thing, I guess. So the book of Numbers describes this travel through the wilderness, this journey through the wilderness, and all of the different events where they can't find any water and they can't got any food, and the manna and the quail and the things that God provides, despite their grumbling, despite the grief that they're giving him, he still travels with them because they're his people. There's some great consolation in that. He doesn't relocate and say, oh, I'll give up with you, I'm going off with the Edomites. They're his people, so despite the fact they grumble and give him grief, he still chooses to show grace and guide them and feed them. Numbers 1:14-20 says, the Lord replied, I've forgiven them, as you asked. Nevertheless, as surely as I live and as surely as the glory of the Lord fills the whole earth, not one of those who saw my glory and the signs I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, but who disobeyed me and tested me 10 times, not one of them will ever see the land I promised on oath to their ancestors. Now that verse comes after a pivotal moment. They'd got to the border of the promised land, Kadesh, and were about to enter. And they sent some spies in to see whether the land was any good or not to live in. And the spies came back and said, it's a fantastic land, but there's rugby players in there. There's massive great giants. If we go in there, we're going to be in dead trouble. And two men said, well, that doesn't matter. We're God's people. We can do that. And the other said, no, we don't want to do that. And so God said, well, if you don't believe me, that's fine. I'm still your God, and I'm still going to travel with you, but you're clearly not ready to go into the promised land yet, so continue your journey. And they do. The next book is the book of Deuteronomy. And the book of Deuteronomy looks two ways. If you haven't got the energy and the time to read Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, read Deuteronomy, because it's kind of a summary book in some ways. It looks back. Moses, now towards the end of his life, having led the people through the desert, makes 3 speeches, looking back to where they've come from. So you get a repeat of the 10 commandments that were given in the book of Exodus for the first time. You get a repeat of some of the other stories as Moses looks back and reflects on the journey so far. But then at the very end of the book of Deuteronomy, looking forward, Moses invites the people of Israel to renew their covenant with God, to recommit themselves to be God's people. And at the end of the book, Moses dies, not quite making it across the River Jordan into the promised land, and Joshua is appointed to lead the people across the Jordan and into the land that God's promised to them. So the book of Joshua is a book about conquest and settlement. By this time now, the people have got to the borders of the River Jordan, just above Galilee, just below Galilee, above the Dead Sea, and they make an incursion into Canaan and begin to take possession of the land that God's given to them. As they do that, there are a number of other tribes who we're told are exceedingly wicked in the way they live. There's horrific things happening in Canaan, and the Canaanites sacrificing their children to other gods and all kinds of things. And Israel gradually displaced most of these tribes. And as they do that, they allocate different bits of the land according to different tribes. And so the land of Israel, as it became known eventually, was allocated out to the 12 families of Abraham's, the tribes that made up Israel. And that's roughly how the land was divided up. One of the interesting and important things to see there is that Judah is towards the south, and Judah eventually becomes all that's left. And we'll see that story as it unfolds. If I had a pointer, I'd show you where Jerusalem was, but you can probably work that out for yourself by seeing where the Dead Sea is. So, they're in the lands, they're settled in the lands. This is wonderful. God's now got a family of people who love him, love one another, and love his planet. If only. If only. If only they loved God. If only they loved one another. And what we find is, in the book of Judges, which is the next book, that the people are now living in the lands, but it's not all harmonious by any means. There's a kind of a cycle that happens in the book of Judges over and over again, like a spin cycle on a washing machine. It keeps happening. The people turn from God. They start worshipping the idols of the land they've taken over or something like that. God judges by delivering them into the hands of their enemies. The people turn back to God. God sends a judge to rescue the people, people like Gideon, people like Samson, people like Judith. There are all kinds of people who are sent as judges. They're leaders. They're not judges with wigs who sit and bang gavels in courtrooms. The judges are political leaders that are raised up to reestablish holiness in the country of Israel. And then there's a period of peace under the judge. And then guess what happens? The people turn from God. God hands them over to their enemies. The people turn back to God. He delivers them. A judge comes, establishes a new rule. And then it all happens again. And so you can just follow that through the book of Judges, that cycle of grief and grace through the book. It doesn't look like the project's going terribly well at this point, it must be said. God's desire to have a worldwide family of people that love him, love one another, and love his planet is kind of struggling at every point. Next to this is the book of Ruth. Some of you will know the book of Ruth, this lovely story of Ruth, the woman who's moves to the new land, and her son dies, her husband dies, she's left with her two daughters-in-law, and she says, go back to her daughters-in-law, you don't belong here, go back to where we came from. And they said, no, we're not going to go. And there's this wonderful thing in the book of Ruth where they make a pledge to their mother-in-law. Oh, don't look at that! Stop, you're cheating. Dare I press the next button? I don't know what's going to happen there. Go. What's on the screen? Okay, let's try this. If it goes again, it goes again. And there's that lovely verse where the two daughters-in-law turn to Ruth and say, wherever you go, we go. Because your family's now our family, and our commitment is to stay with you. It's a lovely story of fidelity. And of course, they then struggle to work out how on earth we're going to survive in this place with no husbands to provide for us. And they come across someone called Boaz, who is the distant relative. And Boaz steps into the gap and he starts providing. And he's called a kinsman redeemer. A kinsman, because he's a member of the family, and a redeemer, because he kind of brings them out of the mess they're in. And the idea of a kinsman redeemer is quite a strong image. Somebody who's in the family, who buys you out of the mess that you're in. When Job... Oh, well, no, I won't distract myself. Time. Right. So, then what happens is, these judges, they do their best. But we get then into the book of Samuel. And at the beginning of the book of Samuel, the Israelites decide they've had enough of judges, and they want a king, like all the other nations. Everyone else has got a king, why can't we have a king? And God says, well, you shouldn't have a king, because if you've got a king, he'll want taxes from you, he'll want you to be his servants, he'll make life hard for you, it won't always turn out well. I'm supposed to be your king. We're supposed to be a theocracy with God in charge. Not a, what do you call a company? Was it? Monarchy, thank you very much. Yes, not a monarchy. Struggling for the word there. But anyway, eventually God says, okay, if you want a king, have a king. And the first king is a guy called Saul. And he doesn't turn out to be a great king because he tries to king Israel, but doesn't listen to what God wants him to do. He makes a very serious gaffe very early in his kingship. And so God replaces him with a young man, a shepherd boy called David. He wasn't from a royal family. He was the smallest in a whole family of people. But the prophet Samuel goes along to his family, and God points out to Samuel that David is the one who should succeed Saul as king. And you get this story of the overlap in the book of Samuel between Saul, who's still king, and David, who's the king in waiting. And David actually works for Saul, and it's a bit of an uneasy relationship, as you might imagine, when the king is in charge, but his kind of servant boy is beginning to become more and more popular than him. And people start singing songs about Saul has slain his thousands, but David's slain his tens of thousands. And, you know, when you're king, you don't like that sort of thing. It's just kind of a little bit belittling. So that was a bit of an awkward period. But eventually David becomes king in his own right. And David's kingdom is the first time in the story of Israel that Israel are united as a land. David's is the golden era in Israel's history. David's kingdom stretches right across that bit of land I had on the map earlier and further still. And it's peaceful. David's a wonderful, wise leader. He's a warrior king. He's also a poet, songwriter. Who wouldn't want to know David? Israel is kind of high point here in terms of its nationhood. David dies, and his son Solomon becomes king. David always had it in his heart to build a resting place for God. God was still living in this tent, and no one likes to live in a tent for very long, do they? It doesn't seem right, really. Any time at all is too much for me. But anyway, God is still in this tabernacle, which at various times has been captured by the Philistines, and that doesn't end well, and then David gets it back and puts it up again. But fundamentally, David wants to build a proper house for God, a proper temple for God. And so he sets his heart on doing that. But God doesn't allow him to do it, but he does allow his son Solomon to do it. So Solomon is the king who, still presiding over his father's united kingdom, to coin a phrase, builds this wonderful house of worship, covered in gold and covered in all the stuff that the tabernacle was covered in, the imagery of the fruit and the vines and so on, all overlaid with gold now. But another Eden, another place for God to dwell in the midst of his people for the sake of the whole world. We get some wonderful stories at the book of 1 Kings where God's presence comes and fills the temple. Just as the tabernacle had been filled in the wilderness with the glory of God, so the temple in 1 Kings, is it 6 or 8, one of you remember, the glory of God comes and fills Solomon's temple. Remember that, because it's very important in the way the story unfolds. Then the story kind of degenerates a bit, in truth, because what then happens is various generations of kings and family members fall out and dispute the kingship, and Israel and Judah split. So the northern kingdom becomes called Israel, where it says Israel on that map on the left, up through to Aram. That became called Israel. And the bit in the south, well, why don't I just show you, becomes called Judah. Rehoboam is king of the south, and Jeroboam is king of the north. And I wish one of them had been called Alfred or Henry, because it makes it almost impossible for me to remember which is which, unless I've got it written down. But those two were at loggerheads, and if you look at the central column down the diagram, you'll see that through the succeeding years, the whole succession of kings are described in the book of Kings and in the book of Chronicles as being king of either the northern kingdom or the southern kingdom. A few of them were really good, and they really did try to govern God's people well, but most of them were pretty corrupt and didn't. And they gave in to other forces, other nations, other gods. And yet, somehow, these were still God's nation. He didn't give up on them. But he did warn them. In the book of Kings, he said, if you do not become the people that I want you to be, if you do not shape up, as it were, then you will lose your right to live in this place. You will be overrun by the other nations. And sure enough, we read in the book of 2 Kings that the northern kingdom, between the years 715 and 734 BC, was overthrown by the Assyrians and were taken captive into exile, never to return. There were a few who were left behind, and there were a few that were imported from Assyria to kind of reside in the land. And that kind of mixed racial background is what formed the Samaritans, who Jesus had a few run-ins with. That's the Samaritans who lived in the northern part of Israel, were kind of the residue that were left over after this great exile about 715 to 734 BC. Assyria was the world superpower at the time, and they conquered northern Israel. You can read all these stories, as I said at the beginning, I'm having to skate across the surface to a certain extent. But what we read at the very end of 2 Kings, the second book of Kings, is that not only the northern kingdom, but Judah itself falls under the same fate. A couple of hundred years later, and now a new superpower is running the world, Babylon. But now they come, Nebuchadnezzar comes, and takes successively prisoners and captives and hostages, and eventually flattens Jerusalem and eventually flattens the temple as Israel are taken into captivity, or southern Israel, Judah, are taken into captivity in Babylon. And we know that life wasn't pleasant for them there. They didn't quite understand how to be God's nation when they weren't in God's land, as they saw it. And so we read in the Psalms, the songbook, of something of their hardship. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars, we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, sing us one of your songs of Zion. But how can we sing the song of the Lord while in a foreign land? It says something about their pain and their frustration at being completely dislocated from where they thought they should be. It seemed that everything was lost. God's plan seemed to have been derailed big time now, because the people that were supposed to be the people that loved him, loved one another, and loved his planet were no longer really where they thought they needed to be in a relationship with God. They didn't have the temple anymore. They didn't have any of their worship's center anymore. How could they worship and love God in a foreign land? But while they're there in that place of exile, in Babylon, we read us some stories of people like Daniel. Daniel's a young man who's taken into exile with the others. And he's a bright young spark. He's spotted, he's talent spotted by Nebuchadnezzar and taken into his court. And he and a few friends eventually become rulers in Babylon. But they never forget their Hebrew roots. They never forget who they are. So they refuse to worship the gods and the kings of Babylon. And you may know the story where one of the rulers of Babylon erects a great statue of himself and says, every time you hear the music play, you've got to bow down and worship my statue. And they say, no, we're not going to do that. He said, well, you better, because I've got a very hot furnace to throw you in if you don't. And you know how the story goes, I'm guessing. But those stories, and the lion's den, Daniel refused not to pray to his God. If you don't, I'm going to pray to my God, even though I'm so far away from where I think I need to be here in exile, I'm still going to pray to my God. Well, if you do that, you're going to get thrown in this den of lions. Fine. So he refused to sacrifice his identity, even though he was investing himself into helping to run Babylon. Daniel's a great book for working out how to live in a place where you don't expect to be, and holding on to faith at the same time. But one of the significant things about the book of Daniel is the visions at the end of the book, if you've read the book. Daniel's given a number of dreams and visions. And those dreams and visions are about, when they're interpreted and understood in the book, they're about a succession of world empires that would come and go. Empires that would rise up, but then fall. Like Assyria, that rose and then fell. Like Babylon itself, that rose and then fell. Like Greece under Alexander the Great, that rose and then fell. And like Rome itself, that rose and then fell. As an aside, for those of us that look at world history and think things are how they'll always be, let's not be deceived. Empires come and empires go. And when you live under the empire, you can't imagine it not being there. But empires are transient. And what Daniel sees in his vision is another empire, another kingdom. A kingdom of God. But in his vision, he sees a human being, or as he describes it, one like a son of man. And this human being, like a son of man, just means a human being, approaches God and receives a kingdom, which he then shares with a people. So God gives his kingdom, in the midst of these other strange visions of kingdoms and empires coming and going, God gives his kingdom to a human being and invites that human being to share them with a body of people. So share God's rule with a body of people. Hang on to that thought. The other Old Testament book that we see from this period is the book of Ezekiel. The prophet Ezekiel He pops up in exile. Ezekiel had been trained as a priest to be a priest in the temple in Jerusalem. But, of course, Jerusalem's now gone. And he's been taken captive into exile. But in exile, Ezekiel gets this incredible vision of God riding on a chariot, thundering across the desert, wheels within wheels, this incredible, like, Popemobile kind of thing, plus. And that encouraged Ezekiel to believe that God wasn't located in the temple in Jerusalem after all, that God was the God of the whole earth. And if his people were in trouble, then God could come to where they were. He didn't need them to come to him. And God gave Ezekiel a number of visions. You know some of them, I'm sure. He gave him a valley of bones scattered across the desert floor and said, could this dead army live again? Of course, the imagery is of Israel, scattered across Babylon, like a lot of dry bones. Is it possible that this nation could become a nation again? And in his vision, Ezekiel sees these bones come together and the foot bones connected to the ankle bone and the ankle bones connected to the shin bone. You know the song. And the whole thing comes together and God breathes life into it. He's given a vision of a little river that flows out of God's temple in Jerusalem east towards where the exiles are. And in this vision, he sees this river getting deeper and deeper and bringing more and more life wherever it goes. In other words, in the most barren of places, Ezekiel is given visions that enable him to believe that despite the lostness and the hopelessness of their situation, God can still rescue them and bring new life. That's the prophet Ezekiel. I hope you're ticking off your Bible books to see how many we've mentioned. And what happens, remarkably, Daniel's vision comes true. Some of these empires begin to wane a little bit. And we see them follow another red line. This time, from right to left, from where they are in exile, back to the promised land. Under leadership of people called Nehemiah and Ezra, they receive permission from the kings of the day to return and to begin to rebuild Jerusalem. It would seem impossible to that first generation of exiles that anything like that could ever happen, and yet it did. God did begin to gather the dry bones off of the floor of the desert and put them back together in Israel. And Nehemiah and Ezra, two great leaders, led successive waves of returnees back to Jerusalem to rebuild the place. And as they were doing so, the prophets Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi begin to speak God's words to Israel again and to encourage them to believe that they're back now and God is with them again. And so they begin to rebuild. They rebuild the temple, they rebuild the walls, they rebuild the gates, they rebuild their houses. But there's one person who's left in exile, well, more than one, there's quite a lot, but there's one that we read about, and that is Esther. Okay, so Esther is a lady, she never makes it back. Esther's story is a story in a foreign place. Esther is a beauty who becomes the king of the time. His heart is captured by Esther's beauty, and she is a Jewess, she's a Hebrew, and she becomes queen in this foreign land at a time when a plot is an anti-Semitic plot is being hatched to do away with the Jews in the land. And Esther, with the help of her uncle, form a way of saving the Jewish people in the land. And that famous phrase, perhaps for just a time like this, I came to this place. Esther was in the right place at the right time to do what God wanted her to do there in that foreign land. But most of God's people returned, and Zerubbabel, good name, Zerubbabel, isn't it? Zerubbabel, he was responsible for rebuilding the temple. Ezra was responsible for rediscovering the law and reading the law to the returnees. And Nehemiah was responsible for rebuilding the gates and the walls of Jerusalem. So those are the three key leaders from this period in Israel's history. They're back home. They're beginning to rebuild. They've got a temple again of sorts. It wasn't as glorious as Solomon's temple, but it was at least going up. But the one thing we never read of this temple is that the glory of God fills it. We read it of Eden, we read it of the tabernacle, we read it of Solomon's temple, but we never read it of this temple. The building goes up, but we never read that God moves in. That's significant. So we've looked at the history books. Do you remember that bookshelf I showed you? We've looked at the history books. Where do the prophets... These are the books we've looked at. 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings. And then the exile, which is happens at the end of 2 Kings, Ezra and Nehemiah. And we've looked at the books of Chronicles as well, which don't appear on this particular graphic. We've seen about the united and then the divided kingdom described in Samuel and Kings. We've seen about the experience in Babylon with Daniel and Ezekiel bring their prophetic words. And we've seen about the return and rebuilding. All of this story is important, as we will see. It's what the Old Testament's all about, this story. So the prophets, that last bunch of people on the shelf, the Old Testament shelf, they're not in chronological order, because the prophets... People who were inspired by God to speak what God wanted said slot into this history. So people like Amos and Hosea were speaking into some of the lives of some of the kings described early in the book of Kings. People like Joel, Micah, Isaiah, Zephaniah, Habakkuk and Jeremiah also were prophesying into the historical situation described in the book of Kings. Fundamentally, they were bringing the message that God is for you, but if you're against him, there will be consequences. Now, in its shortest possible way, that's fundamentally what the prophets are saying. And some of them added, but don't worry, there's also hope. In various ways, they described that hope. Jonah, Nahum, Obadiah, Daniel and Ezekiel, I've already said, in the period of exile. And the period of return, Haggai, Zechariah and Malachi. All of these prophets speaking into the life of Israel. Here's some words from the prophet Isaiah. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me, because the Lord has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives and release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, and provide for those who grieve in Zion. Now, Isaiah announced those words about 700 BC. And they point to something that's important to spot about Old Testament prophecy, which is that they have a number of fulfillments. So when Isaiah, imagine Isaiah, who can you imagine Isaiah looking like? Bill Oddie. Let's imagine that Isaiah looked at, he just needed a prophetic-like looking, you know, beard and quite, anyway. He stands up and he announces this to people. They don't immediately think, ah, yes, I know, this means something in 700 years' time. They need some current frame of reference to understand it. Now, it might be that God's giving them hope for the future, but they need to begin to understand that here and now, these words give us hope. Here and now, God is wanting to bring good news. Here and now, as we return from exile, God's wanting to move amongst us. But most Old Testament prophecy has a second frame of reference, which is that it points forwards to Christ as well. And this one, as some of you, many of you, all of you perhaps will know, was actually picked up by Jesus in Luke chapter 4, and he used this to describe his own ministry 700 years after it was written. But the other thing is, there are elements of this which are not fulfilled in the life of Jesus Christ, but they are yet to be fulfilled. There is a fulfillment at some point in the future. So Jesus deliberately chose not to use the words, and the day of vengeance of our God. He stopped to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, full stop at that point. Because that was describing what he'd come for and the era we now live in. So there's an element of that prophecy which is as yet unfulfilled. So when we read Old Testament prophecy, we always wanted to ask those three questions. How much of this was describing events at the time, which are now past historic events that have come to pass? Some of Daniel's visions of the rise of the Assyrian Empire and the Babylonian Empire, those are clearly historic prophecies. They've come to pass in the events at the time. How much of these are pointing forwards towards the coming of Jesus Christ, and how much of this has yet to be fulfilled at some point in the future. There are usually three trajectories. Some prophecies hit all three, some focus in particular on one, but we should always ask those three questions. So, in all of that history, we're near at the end of the Old Testament, I'll let you stand up and breathe at that point. Through all of that history that's described at the top of the screen there, all the kings and the temple building and the exile and the return and the prophets and so on, they were thinking deeply about life. They were thinking deeply about where God was in all of this. They were thinking deeply about how to live lives. And this collection of books that was in the middle of the top shelf on my initial diagram, the so-called wisdom books, is a collection of books which contain their best thinking and their best poetry and their best worship songs, which describe and interact with the history that I've just described to you. The Song of Songs, sometimes called the Song of Solomon, attributed to Solomon, whether or not he actually wrote it, we don't know, which is a song about sexual love between a husband and wife. They thought about those sorts of things in those days. It's shocking, isn't it? But they did, and they wrote a book about it, and it even got into the Bible. Imagine that. Proverbs. Incidentally, for centuries, many commentators have chosen to say it's about the love between God and his people, and there clearly is a frame of reference there, but it's also clearly not the only frame of reference for the Book of Song of Songs. Proverbs, a number of short, pithy sayings about the wisdom for living life. Better to live with a dripping tap than on a roof with a nagging woman, for example. Just randomly chosen out of a number. The Book of Ecclesiastes, which is, you know, what's life all about? And, oh dear, I tried to be rich and that didn't make me happy. I tried to get a good job and that didn't make me happy. I tried to get drunk and have loads of fun and that didn't make me happy. What's life all about? Is the big question of Ecclesiastes. And the word that keeps coming in the Book of Ecclesiastes is the word breath or wind, often translated meaningless. Meaningless, meaningless, it's all meaningless. What on earth is this human existence all about? It's just a puff of wind, it's nothing to it. So they're wrestling with some of the questions that we wrestle with today. The Book of Psalms, 150 prayers, hymns and songs of Israel, interacting again with particular bits in the history. So Psalm 51, as one example, you will know, interacts with David's experience of committing adultery with Bathsheba and his shame at being found out and his guilt at being found out. And that great penitent psalm where he cries out to God and asking, Lord, forgive me, I've done wrong. Deliver me from this. Don't take your Holy Spirit from me. Create in me a clean heart, O God. It's a specific thing. So a lot of the psalms interact with particular bits of history, and that's how we understand what they're all about. The Book of Job, some people say it was written quite late in Israel's history. Some people say it was written quite early in Israel's history. But it's a reflection, a deep reflection on suffering. Where is God when it all goes wrong? It's a fantastic book, a very contemporary book. Where is God and how do we behave when it feels like God is absent and everything's gone wrong? Everything we expected doesn't happen. The big question of the Book of Job is, can the righteous suffer? And the answer is yes. Then you don't have to read it now. So we get to the end of the Old Testament. We're doing okay. We're going to make it. We've still got the ish bit to go. We'll be fine. The end of the Old Testament. The last book is Malachi in our version of the Bible. We then have 400 years of history in which nothing happens in as far as the Bible's concerned. Historically, what happens is Alexander the Great's empire rules over the East, the Middle East. Alexander the Great, as you may know, was an incredible warrior and ruler, but died quite young. And when he died, his empire was divided up between four of his generals. And in Israel, they were under a particular general who was particularly oppressive, and there were a series of revolts by the Jews against their overlords, one in particular by a man called Judas Maccabeus, who led an armed revolt against the Romans, who by then had taken over from Alexander's generals. And you get all those stories. Now, those stories are contained in what are called the apocryphal books. most Protestants don't have them in their Bible. Most Catholics and some Anglicans do. They're books like Maccabees and Judith and Tobit and so on. You might have them in your Bible, depending on which Bible you've got. They're sandwiched in between. They describe this period of history. This is how they were described in a very early version of the Bible. These books were not received by a common consent to be read and expounded publicly in the church. And they did not serve to prove any point of Christian religion, save in so much as they had the consent of the other scriptures, called canonical, to confirm the same. So it's fine if other bits of the Bible confirm them. If it didn't, not fine. Nonetheless, as books proceeding from godly men, they were received to be read for the advancement and furtherance of the knowledge of history, describing this period, and for the instruction of godly manners. So if you want some godly manners and you want to know about this period of history, read the apocryphal books. But we might ask a question at this stage. Has God's project failed? Has his project to have a worldwide family of people that love him, love one another, and love his planet failed? His people are back together again in their land, but he doesn't seem to have joined them. The glory of the Lord has not refilled the temple. So in one sense, they're a nation again, but in the very important sense, they're not. Because the glory of God has not revisited them. So has God given up on them? 400... Don't get ahead of me. So don't be anxious. I'm not going to say he has. I'm asking the question. Has God given up on them? 400 years is a long time to wait. And that's what's happening. So stand up, turn around, take a deep breath, say hello to someone, and we will then, by 8 o'clock, somehow or other, complete the New Testament. Okay, folks, that's it. It was just a brief break. So we left the question hanging. Has the project failed or not? And the answer came in a very surprising form. The answer came in the form of a baby. No one expected that. No one expected that the answer to the dilemma that Israel were in would come in the form of a baby. But notice what the baby was called. In a land that was lacking the presence of God, this baby would be called Emmanuel, God with us. The resolution of the Old Testament exile, which had not yet been fully completed, because the presence of God had not returned to his people, suddenly was completed in the birth of this child and the living of this life. God came to his people. John chapter 1 tells us that we have beheld his glory. John chapter 1. Well, that was the very thing that Israel hadn't beheld for 400 years. The very thing they were waiting for was the return of God to his temple, the glory of God to fill this temple they'd rebuilt on return of exile. It hadn't happened. There was no glorious display of God's presence. But now we're told the glory of the Lord was seen, but in an unexpected shape and size. And we find at the beginning of the New Testament, the New Covenant books, these books by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, each written for a different readership, books describing this life, the life of Jesus, virtually undescribed from his birth to the age of 30, but then exploding into 3 years of activity, his baptism, his teaching, his miracles, his calling of disciples, his death and resurrection. And what the New Testament the gospel writers are intent on doing over and over and over again, each of them in their own way, is to show us that this life is the culmination of the story that I've just been telling you. This life is now God's presence in the earth. This life is now Emmanuel, God with us. This life is now come to reform a new covenant. Remember what Jesus said at the Last Supper? This is the new covenant sealed with my blood. This life has now come to deal with the effects of rebellion and exile and to form the new family of God, founded now not on 12 Old Testament fathers, but now founded on the 12 disciples. This child has come to bring redemption and freedom and fullness of life. What Israel had longed for, this child came to bear to them. This child came to secure the kind of restoration that Israel longed for. It didn't come in an expected shape, and the timing wasn't entirely what they expected. But over and over again, the gospel writers, in different ways, are pointing to the fact that all of that Old Testament history is summed up in this one life. Matthew tells us that the very fabric of that story, all of the law and the prophets, has not been abolished by this life. This isn't a new story. This is the fulfillment, the completion of that story. That story was leading to this life, which relaunches the story in a new direction. On the road to Emmaus, he told his friends that he was walking with, "How foolish you are, how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory?" And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. And I wish we had time. We could have an hour and a half at least just doing just this. But here is the lamb, here is the Passover lamb, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. Here is the bread of life that's come down from heaven like the manna in the Old Testament. Here is the one who says, "I am the light of the world," just as Israel were called to be a light to the world but failed. Here is the one who constantly called himself the Son of Man, the Son of Man, the Son of Man. He's deliberately locating himself in that story from Daniel of the one who receives a kingdom from God and brings it into the earth and shares it amongst others. "I am the new temple," Jesus said. "You tear down this temple," he said, looking at Herod's temple, "and I'll rebuild it in 3 days," talking about his own death and resurrection. He was the one who stood up in the temple and said, "If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink, and out of his innermost being will flow rivers of living water." And he said that in the very feast that was commemorating Ezekiel's vision in Ezekiel's prophecy. He located himself as the source of that river of life. He is the one who said, "I am the vine and my Father." In the Old Testament, Israel was God's vine that was plucked up and transplanted into Canaan. Jesus comes and says, "I'm the vine. My Father's the gardener. You're the branches." Israel is called God's son. Jesus identifies himself as the Son of God. And Jesus clearly locates himself in Isaiah's story of the suffering servant who suffers for the sins of the world, who's beaten for sins that he didn't commit in order that others could be set free. Those are just a small... Oh, hang on, there's another one. He is the one who is David's son. Back in 2 Samuel, David is promised a son who will rule forever. Jesus is located in that story of David's family line, the son who eventually will establish a kingdom that will reign forever. Vision after vision, prophecy after prophecy, image after image, historical act after historical act, all flows into this one life. Because at this moment, now, God himself has intervened in human history to relaunch the project that Israel failed to fulfill, to secure for God a worldwide family of people who love him, love one another, and love his planet. Jesus came to be the savior of the world. And so all of the books of the Old Testament, and then all of the subsequent books of the New Testament, find their bearings in this one life. The life of Jesus Christ. Living, teaching, dying, raised again, and ascended. That story is the story that makes sense of everything else. The whole Old Testament narrative finds its full stop in Jesus. And anything else that still flows on flows now through the filter of Jesus into the future. There's no bit of the Old Testament that kind of jumps over Jesus and carries on. Some of it stops in Jesus. So the sacrificial system in the temple, for example, stops in Jesus because now the final sacrifice has been paid. We don't need to keep sacrificing animals. So some of it stops in Jesus. Some of it continues in Jesus. For example, the call to be the light to the world, which was Israel's call, Jesus said, I am the light of the world. But he turned to his followers and said, listen, we've now got to get on with this together. You are the light of the world, Matthew 5. The commission of Israel is filtered through Jesus and passed on to his followers. Some of it stops with Jesus, some of it continues through Jesus into his family, which now becomes God's family in the earth. The church is called to be that family of people that Israel failed to be. The church is kind of Israel expanded, Israel exploded. Israel, it's not Israel's been displaced, but Israel has now been expanded into something else as we are invited into that trajectory of God's purposes. Following the life of Jesus, we read in the book of Acts that the apostles who spent their time with Jesus were filled with the Holy Spirit, and they took the wonderful good news of God's intervention. God is now with us. The glory of the Lord has returned to the earth. There is no hope for humankind. We are now all invited, Jew and Gentile, into God's family. They took this wonderful good news into the streets of Jerusalem, but then the book of Acts tells how, filled with the Holy Spirit, they took this good news to Rome. The significance of the book of Acts is this movement of the good news from the center of the Jewish faith to the center of the Gentile world. That's the symbolic relocation of the good news. Starting with the Jewish apostle Peter, but continued in the second half of the book of Acts with the Apostle Paul, who understood himself to be the Apostle to the Gentiles. So we see this movement of God's story out of its purely Israel setting into an Israel redefined setting as Paul, the Jewish Apostle, takes the Jewish good news to the Gentiles and tries to work out how on earth that works. He starts churches all around the Mediterranean. And most of the New Testament books that Paul wrote are written to the churches that he himself started. So, the Gospels, I've already said, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, the history of how that good news expanded in the book of Acts. And then in the New Testament, we've got a whole slew of letters by Paul to the church in Rome, to the church in Corinth, to the church in Galatia. These are places where, in current modern day jargon, Paul had been the church planter. He'd started the church. And so he was writing to his spiritual children. Then at the end of the New Testament, we've got letters written to the Hebrews, the Jewish Christians, by the Apostle James, Jesus' brother, by Peter, by John, and by Jude. And then finally, we've got the book of Revelation. Again, as with the Old Testament, these books are not in chronological order. So perhaps one of the first books to be written was probably James and Galatians. The Gospels themselves weren't written down until slightly later in the first century, when the apostles began to be concerned that a new generation of people who hadn't known Jesus were around, and they wanted to make sure that people knew the authentic good news of Jesus. And so the apostles wrote down, or the writers of the Gospels wrote down the authentic stories of Jesus to make sure that people understood who Jesus really was. But the initial good news was carried by mouth, not by letter. And the epistles themselves, the letters, really are almost all categorized by three themes. There's some teaching: who is Jesus and what difference has he made? Most of Paul's letters start with that. Who is Jesus? What was that life all about and what difference has he made? There's usually a fairly strong dose of troubleshooting, as the churches were getting it wrong in various ways and different people were carrying on in different ways and arguing and falling out and fighting and committing adultery with one another, all sorts of things in the church. Can you imagine it? When people say we would like to be a New Testament church, I think, well, which one would you like to be, personally? Well, let's not develop that time. But often they're very situational pieces of writing. They're writing to address particular issues in particular places. And we need to understand that when we read them, that the issues that we're facing may not be the same issues. So we need to understand what issues were being faced so that we can understand how we can read it today. And then out of those two things, out of the teaching and out of the troubleshooting, there's usually some training about how we then live as followers of Jesus. How do you live as a husband? How do you live as a wife? How do you live as an employer? How do you live as an employee? How do you do those sorts of things? Given that Jesus has come, what difference does it make? So they're all looking at themes of what difference does it make? Once you weren't a people, you were a scattered ragbag of Gentiles, but now you are the people of God. Once you were in the kingdom of darkness, but now you're in the kingdom of light. Once you lived your life in Adam's family tree, but now you're living in Jesus' family tree. Once you lived in the flesh, just in charge of yourself, but now you can live in the power of the Holy Spirit. Once you were slaves to sin, but now you're slaves of God. Once you were under the law, but now you're under grace. Once you were living behind the curtain, separated off away from God, but now you can boldly approach the throne of God. Once you were citizens of the world, now you're citizens of heaven. I could have plucked, you know, we could have screen after screen after screen. That's what the New Testament's trying to do. It's trying to locate us not in a new set of behavior, but in a new identity. This is who you are. Always comes before. This, therefore, is how you should live. Understanding who you are as a child of God is where the new behavior issues from. But the new behavior is there. You used to please yourself, Paul writes, but now you should live to please your brother or sister. You used to be happy with sexual license, but now you're called to sexual purity. You used to work for your living, but now you're supposed to work for your Lord. You used to push yourself forward, but now you should defer to one another. You used to dominate your wife, now you should sacrifice your life for your wife in the way that Jesus sacrificed himself for the church. You used to be your own woman, now you should submit to your husband. You used to get even, now you should give grace. You used to let rip, now you should guard your lips. You could go on and on and on. I was having fun at that point, but I ran out of PowerPoint screen, so I stopped myself. But issue after issue, throughout the epistles, what you're seeing is a reorientation of people's understanding. These Gentiles who had no religious background and certainly didn't have the Hebrew story in their locker, they had to suddenly work out what it meant. Who was Jesus for them? And given that Jesus was that for them, how should they then live? That's fundamentally what the epistles are all about. The final book is not an epistle, but it's called an apocalypse. The word apocalypse simply means revelation. And the book of Revelation tells the story of the triumph of God and God's people at the end of time. It starts with seven letters, which gives us a clue to the book. The seven letters were written to some of those churches that I had on the map on the screen just now. And those churches were under pressure. The Roman Empire was trying to squash the church. Christians were living in similar conditions to Christians today in the Middle East, in Egypt and in Pakistan and in Iraq and so on. The book of Revelation was written to churches under that sort of pressure. People were giving up their faith, they were being killed because they were Christian. What on earth was going on? This new family called the church, that was to be the family of people who loved God, loved one another and loved God's world, suddenly seemed to be being extinguished by the powers of the time. And what the book of Revelation does is it pulls back the curtain on the world that surrounds the world we can see. It gives us a glimpse into the heavenly courts, as it were, in which human history is being shaped. The first thing we see when we pull back the curtain It's like that. Pull back the curtain. See? These are the slides that I'm most pleased with. So a little appreciation. The first thing, when John is given by the Holy Spirit the power to pull back the curtain, the first thing he sees after we've read those seven letters is a throne with someone seated on it. Even when the church apparently is being extinguished, just like when Israel was apparently being extinguished in Babylon, there's still hope, because actually whatever is happening on the earth, God is still on the throne. That's really hard to believe when your family's being killed for their faith. But that's what the book of Revelation encourages us to believe, that in tough circumstances, God is still on the throne. That's where the vision starts. But then the vision descends into this kind of cosmic warfare that's symbolized by all kinds of savage beasts who apparently are trying to undermine God's project to have a worldwide family of people that love him, love one another, and love his planet. They're trying to derail this project. And we see symbolically these beasts that appear in the earth trying to defeat God's purposes, trying to devour God's people, trying to distract them and wipe them out. But then towards the end of the book, in chapter 19, we see this fantastic image of a rider on a white horse who comes to battle the beasts. The Lord of Lords is written on his thigh. Here's Jesus in this image, this vision, coming to destroy the beasts that are opposed to God in this final battle. And one by one, the pieces of evil in God's creation are dismantled. Warfare, oppression, starvation, they're all consigned until finally evil itself is consigned to the fire. And what we see at the end of the book is a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and he who was seated on the throne said, I'm making everything new. What we see at the end of the book is what we saw at the beginning of the book. God is determined to create a beautiful place in which he can place people in his image who together with him will make this whole thing work. At the end of the story, we see the beginning of the story. But now, the problem that caused the problem, the presence of evil, that snake in the garden, has just been consigned to the bonfire. There's no risk of a repeat performance. And so what we see at the end of the story is that God does actually get what he wants. We see that he gets this worldwide family of people who love him, love one another, and love his planet. There's no more crying or grieving or mourning or pain. There's no more grumbling in the wilderness. There's no more emptiness in the temple. In fact, the Lord is the temple. What was Eden is now the whole world. What was the tabernacle is now the whole world. What was the temple is now the whole world. What was Christ is now everything. All in him and him in all. And that is the story of the Bible.